Welcome everybody to a new Sefer and a new Parsha, Bamidbar 57:66. We just concluded last week the Sefer of Vayikra, which has everything, the central ideas and principles of the entire Torah. And we went through a summary of the contents of each of the Parshas in Vayikra to demonstrate that. It had everything from the purpose of the laws, and the motivation for the laws. Vayikra is mitzvah city. It's got almost all the mitzvahs. And now we're about to start a new Sefer, Bamidbar, which has very, very few mitzvahs. Many of the parshios have none. I'd like to start off by asking a question. Why is it so important that there be a book of Bamidbar in the Torah? If, in fact, it doesn't really contain that many mitzvahs, isn't that what the Torah is for? True, Bereishis has very few mitzvahs, but Bereishis, we understand, is the founding fathers, the foundation that the Jewish nation is built upon, and creates the background and the context for the mitzvahs, together with Shmos. But once we've set the stage, we've laid the foundation, we've learned all the mitzvahs, why a book of Bamidbar? Just to tell stories? What are these stories illustrating? And why is it so crucial to the mission of the Torah? You can't have an entire book out of five that doesn't have a major, major contribution to the concept of the Torah. We cannot imagine or accept that Bamidbar is not just as important as Vayikra. To be one-fifth of the Pentateuch, we cannot accept that Bamidbar is any less crucial than the other Chumashim. So really the question is, before we get started, what are we going to learn about? What dimension of the Torah is going to be revealed in this book that we're not going to get from any of the other books? I think that's a very, very central question. I started to make a list of the topics of Bamidbar, you know, just to whet your appetite. I mean, in Bamidbar we have certain things about the way the camp was set up, but there are some very famous stories in Bamidbar. The story of the spies, the story of Korach and his rebellion, the story of the Jewish people and their discontent with the desert, with the lack of real food, and traveling, more traveling. It seems like it's got a unique flavor to it, but why exactly is it crucial for the Torah? If we are to follow Vayikra, why isn't that enough? Granted, we need the oral Torah to give us the details of these laws, but convince me of what my mission is, give me my marching orders, and now let me get to work. What is missing? So the answer to this is something that we have mentioned before in the book of Bereishis, the concept of the klal and the prat, which, if you recall, I got very excited about because we discussed this around the time of Hanukkah, and Rav Matthias Weinberg was the inspiration in a large degree of this concept. The klal and the prat is something which is overarching in Judaism, in the Torah, and everything. And that is, the klal means the general, and the prat means the specific. This is such a crucial concept for anything that is meaningful. You know, in the Torah, with God, with Jewish people, there's also a klal and a prat. There is God, who is the klal of the world. Everything is contained within Him. He is one. That means He contains everything else. And the Torah is part of that klal. Here are the eternal laws and guidelines that apply to everyone without exception, at all times, at all places. That is the klal. To add one more klal, there's the klal Yisrael, there's the entirety of the Jewish people, which is a concept. It's bigger than the sum of its parts. It is an entity. It has its own life, its own soul. It is eternal also. It cannot be destroyed by even when individual members of that klal pass away. There is still a klal. It doesn't die, as the sages say. But then, of course, all of these things can be divided into pratim, into specific parts. The easiest to see is people. I mean, together as people, we form the Klal Yisrael. But no two people are alike. No one ever was, is, or will be like you. Yes, and I'm talking to you. So, where are the rules for me? Where are the rules for the uniqueness of me? Just the mere fact that there is a Klal and a Prat poses certain challenges. We're going to focus on the people aspect of Klal and Prat. There is the challenge of discovering the uniqueness of that Prat. First, discovering my own uniqueness. There is the self-discovery. There is discovering the uniqueness in others. Everybody has strengths. Everybody has a gift. Everybody has something to contribute that no one else can exactly like they can. What happens when a Prat is so unique, when a single unit is so unique and is so different that they begin to be so different than the Klal, and they wander away from the Klal, and their mission becomes a self-centered mission? What happens if an individual Prat says, I wish to be connected with another Prat, but how do I do that? We're different. What if an individual wants to form a group? That's even more Pratim, trying to come together with some commonality of purpose. How do you form a group? And let's say that there are already groups, but there's this group and then there's that group. How do groups form a connection? How can groups work with each other? In sum, the challenge of Klal and Prat is, how do you reconcile the differences with the commonality of identity and purpose? That's a human problem. That's the way Hashem created it. I don't know if there's too much in Sefer Bereishis about this, by the way. But when it gets down to the laws in Vayikra, I don't know how much instruction there is for these challenges. I think that we could give a group of people, 600,000 people, a set of laws in Vayikra, and they would take them home, and the next morning they would set out to perform them, and they would just fall apart because everyone's different. And are we individuals? Are we a group? What shul do I go to? How do I live with my neighbor? So the rules are great, and we all adhere to the rules, but when you get into real life, it's not so simple. So I would like to suggest that Sefer Bamidbar is the book of the Torah that teaches us how Jewish people who are committed to Sefer Bereishis, Shemos, and Vayikra, how they go about living their lives. And therefore, we're not going to focus on the mitzvahs. We're not going to have a lot of mitzvahs, but we're going to have an entire book, an entire fifth of the Torah dedicated to teaching us how to mesh the Klal and the Prat of our existence. That is my proposal to you for your consideration in a general sense. And I would like to welcome the challenge for myself and for you all here to try to see if that working definition, that proposed working definition, will add understanding and guidance as we go through the book of Bamidbar. I would like to maybe take a look at the first parsha and maybe go into the second parsha and to try to see if some of these sections and topics covered would bear out support or otherwise this proposal. Some of the topics in Bamidbar, I would say that the first two and a half parshios do not contain stories. They contain laws, maybe not all of them laws that would go into the reckoning of the 613 commandments, because some of these are laws or instructions for the generation of Jews that dwelled in the desert. They had not yet entered the land of Israel, so consequently they had to have instructions about where everybody's going to live. That would not be a perpetuated mitzvah, because after we get into the land of Israel, there will be no unified camp where we're all in a formation and we have to march a certain way. But there are definitely instructions that were pertinent to that generation. After the 2.5 parshios, then we start getting into stories. So I would say that part of Bamidbar is instructions for the people, part of it is real stories. But let me mention a couple of the topics and see how they may fit into our theme. In Parshas Bamidbar, we have a census. That occupies quite a few verses. A census of all the tribes and all of the members of those tribes. Perhaps from here we see, right at the outset, that in terms of Klal and Prat, in terms of living with the total group and the individual group, the census teaches us that everybody counts. Everybody counts. We cannot get lost. We cannot afford to get lost in the crowd and to say that we don't matter. Because everybody had to be counted. Everybody had to give their half shekel. And it went into the definition of our people. Rabbi Tatz, I'm going to be referring to something that he writes because he very much develops this idea. But one thing particularly he writes, what is your particular task? What essential part of the world is yours to build? This question is critically important. A life spent pursuing some unrealistic and inappropriate goal is a life wasted, and worse, it damages the entire world. One individual wastes his or her life, and they have damaged the entire world. He compares it to a screw in a machine. The screw is tiny, but if it wasn't there, the whole machine wouldn't work. So, Bamidbar, let's start off, everybody is going to be counted. That means everybody counts. So that's number one. That is an important lesson in the Klal versus Prat. Yes?
I think it says there that they counted all the men 20 to 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Wives and children and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And thank goodness, because, I mean, it was only those guys that ended up dying in the 40 years.
That's because the 20 to 60 defines a household, which is another lesson in Klal and Prat, which is that the Jewish people are not just made of individual people, but of units. And that's a family unit, potentially. A woman, for example, her unique contribution is in being the heart of that family unit. Her name doesn't have to be listed separately. You know, when you count somebody, you're basically counting the family. And therefore, it is not really accurate to say that there are 1,200,000 adults, because that's missing the idea of the family structure. That is not to say that the woman is not significant. It's just to say that her significance is in being the heart of that unit, not in being a new unit. That's how I would explain that one.
You know, one of the things, so the very first thing you mentioned was about the counting of the one, each individual.
Yes.
But then right in that same thing, it says, Mishkosam Levei Savosam. So,
It tells you that it's family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Oh,
right there.
That says it all the time.
Yeah.
Very good. Mishkosam. Right. That makes a lot of sense. And that answers the question about how come we're only counting certain people.
Yeah.
Yashar Koach. Very good. Let me finish some of these topics, and then we'll go back and take more questions, now that I think of it, because hopefully this would generate a lot of discussion. So the census teaches us that everybody counts. The next part of the Parsha is the setting up of the camp. And we've spoken about this before. Rav Dessler has a whole essay on the order of the camp, and each tribe living in a certain spot. And there were basically four quadrants. Each quadrant housed three of the tribes. And the choice of which tribes would live with whom was deliberate. And, you know, for example, and I'm not going to review this whole thing, but the Midrash says that Yehuda encamped with Yisachar and Zevulun. Every tribe has its own unique tribal quality. Yehuda's tribal quality was kingship. Yisachar's tribal quality was Torah learning. Zevulun's tribal quality was commerce. And therefore, the placing of these tribes together suggests that in order for there to be proper kingship and leadership, there must be the basis of Torah learning and support for that Torah learning. In order for the leadership to be good, in order for the commerce to be meaningful, it has to be used to support Torah learning. In order for the Torah learning to come to fruition, there has to be leadership, etc., etc. The combining and the coalescing of these groups, of these tribes, has a wisdom unto its own. And so this, of course, is another strong lesson in taking the uniqueness, having them interplay, and creating something for the greater whole. Interesting. I never really thought about this much, but after starting to look at it this way, I see that there's a short paragraph in Bamidbar. This would be on... No, it's in Naso. That's why it's not here. Bamidbar is mostly the census and the camp. And it continues into Naso. There's also the breakdown of the Levites and their camps. In Naso, after we complete all of the encampments, there's a chapter 5, purification of the camp, in which it says, Hashem told Moshe, command the children of Israel that they shall expel from the camp everyone with saras, everyone who has had a zav emission, everyone contaminated by human corpse, male and female alike, shall you expel to the outside of the camp. What kind of an instruction is this? It's very clear. When you have a klal, and you have an individual that starts to stray from that klal, becomes impure, and whatever that means, whatever the implications of impurity, but some type of an imbalance, it affects everybody. And so this individual has to go outside of the klal, has to separate him or herself until it can be correct that impurity, then come back. That's a big klal prat example, where every individual affects the klal. And you can't have somebody impure being in the midst of the people without it affecting everybody else. So that's like a perfect example of this theme. You have the law of the sota and the law of the nazir. These are two laws. I really should be saving this for next week, but maybe we'll think of something else for next week. You have the sota and the nazir, the wayward wife, or the suspected wayward wife, and the nazir is the Nazirite, who accepts upon himself additional restrictions. No drinking wine, no contact with the dead. These, at first glance, don't seem to have a lot in common, but they're very much. It is the story, it is the treatment of an individual who does something different than the klal. In the case of the sota, she's an individual who decided that her unique pursuit was more important than the general good, the good of her family, the good of her unit. And so she becomes wayward. How do we deal with such a person? Or how about the nazir on the other extreme? Here's an individual that says, I'd like to go beyond that which the klal is doing. I want to do extra. I want to raise myself. Is there anything that I can do for extra credit? You know how the smart students in the class say to the teacher, is there anything else we can do for extra credit? What do you do for that person? A good classroom teacher has the ability to do remediation and also to do enrichment. So these are beautiful examples, the sota and the nazir. One is remediation and one's enrichment. But it's the story of the prat and the klal. Moving on. Every once in a while, the Torah comes in with a huge klal builder, something that reminds us that we are all together, we're all unified. Because sometimes when you work on that specialization, you lose touch with the klal. And so after the nazir and the sota, what do we have? Birkas Kohanim, the priestly blessing. The priestly blessing is when everybody, whatever tribe you're from, whatever rank and serial number you are, you all come together under the outstretched arms of the Kohanim and you get the blessing. May Hashem bless you and keep you. May He shine His countenance upon you. V'yasem lecha shalom. May He grant you peace. Peace. You're all together. Remember, every day, as it was in the temple, everybody would have to come together to get that priestly blessing. So that big klal builder. And there are other examples of where some of them are dealing with the development of the prat. and some for the klal. There's a beautiful example which the commentators speak at length in Naso, that in the inauguration of the Mishkan, every tribal leader brought a gift. And it was a gift of animals for sacrifices and other things, wagons and some other things. And the Torah describes each gift. First the gift of Yehuda's tribe, then the gift of Yisachar's tribe, etc. And we're shocked to find out that each gift was exactly the same. And yet the Torah went through painstakingly, listening to that Torah reader, repeat, repeat, that's what makes Nasa the longest parsha in the Torah with 176 pesukim. And the famous explanation, even though they were all doing the same thing on the outside, but each one was unique because each tribe had its own unique quality which was motivating them to give that gift. A beautiful example of klal and prat, of how everybody can do the same thing and yet add unique intention and motivation for that. Another perfect example for this theme of Bamidbar. You have a lot of treatment of the Levim. The Levim creates a subgroup, a culture within a culture. There's so much to learn just about the Levim, and which we've talked about also before. A group that separates itself for the purpose of providing inspiration for the rest of the group. Again, a beautiful example of Prat and Klal coming together. We have other mitzvahs of subgroups. Remember in Bahaloscha, this is already in the third Parsha, we have the group of people that came before Moshe on the first commemoration of Pesach. And they were told to bring a paschal lamb. And a group comes to Moshe and says, Moshe, we're impure. We had to go to a funeral. We cannot bring the paschal lamb. What are we going to do? We're going to miss out on the Korban Pesach. And Moshe says, good question. I'll ask Hashem. He comes back and he says, you have a makeup, Pesach Sheni. It's a beautiful example of Klal and Prat. Here we have, everyone's doing the Korban Pesach. It's good for us all. And yet there's one group that missed out. And they want to, how can they be accommodated? And so they are accommodated. And once again, we have that message of unity. We have in Baha'u'llah the cloud which enveloped the camp, the fire pillar which walked before them, the calling of the trumpets. Again, all of these things proclaiming unity. So the Torah in Sefer Bamidbar is replete with aspects of klal or prat or synthesizing the two. And then there are stories. Then start the stories, and hopefully we will deal with them as they come along. But there are stories about, as we mentioned before, a group starts to complain. Okay, people that are individuals are entitled to have an opinion, are entitled to have a question, are entitled to say, I've got a problem here. Hey, listen to me. If you say, we're not listening, you're not acknowledging the prat. But what happens if they complain and it disheartens everybody else? What do you do with it? How does Moshe deal with complainers? That's an important fact. That is just as important part of the Torah as is bringing sacrifices. How do you deal with people who have a problem among the group? And we have the story of the Meraglim. Same thing. Some people went to the land. Some people saw it this way. Other people saw it that way. They came back and they gave the reports. What do you do when people have differences of opinion? And maybe some people are motivated by greed. How do you know what their motivation is? When do you ask for Hashem's intervention? These are all real issues. Moshe's sister and brother started to talk about Moshe and saying, why does he have to separate from his wife? It's a beautiful example of klal and prat. How come he has to be different? How come he can't be like us? Okay, let's deal with that question. Hashem steps in and he says, let me tell you something. He has different responsibilities. You're prophets, you're wonderful people. Moshe has a different responsibility. He has to be on hand anytime. Again, settling differences because there is a way to reconcile between the klal and the prat. Anyway, those are some examples. But I would like to attempt to hold on to this theme as a possible guidepost for studying the book of Bamidbar, and to come to see how this is as essential, even though it doesn't have the formal mitzvahs that you'll find in the 613, but it is essential to living a life of Torah as the other books. If I could make a possible connection between this and the upcoming Yom Tov, Shavuos is in just less than a week, I saw a beautiful explanation. It's called Sifsei Chaim. It is the writings of Rav Chaim Friedlander, which I've quoted before. He was maybe the number one student of Rav Dessler, and he taught in Israel, in Bnei Brak, and also in Netivot, a smaller yeshiva where I had the privilege of studying for 1 year, and I personally got to hear Musar talks from Rav Friedlander. And he speaks about two themes. The theme of receiving the Torah, which the weeks leading up to Shavuos are for that purpose, preparing ourselves, climbing day by day to receive the Torah, and also the account of the students of Rabbi Akiva who perished during this time. And that's why we observe mourning. And he asks, what's the connection between the students of Rabbi Akiva, which is really a sad thing, and anticipating the receiving of the Torah, which is a happy thing? And basically, he explains, and I'm making a long story short, that the Talmud says that these students perished because as the bearers of the torch, those who would transfer the Torah from one generation to the next, they had a flaw. The flaw was in the way that they treated one another. The sages say, "Lo nahagu kavod zeh lazeh." They didn't treat each other with respect. And that's a famous statement, and it has to be explained. How could great men, how could students of Rabbi Akiva not treat each other with respect? What do they do? Make faces at each other, stick out their tongue, and then said, "I don't want to play with you." These are grown men. And Rav Chaim Friedlander basically says that there's one human characteristic which is a flaw, and that is the characteristic of Tsarus Ayin. Tsarus Ayin means narrow eyes. Narrow eyes. It's a human malady. Basically, narrow eyes means that I really like to see the world from my narrow perspective. I've got blinders on. I see very clearly what's right in front of me, but I have a hard time seeing what's on the other side, my friend. And even when I work with him, even when I study with him, I'm looking at him from my perspective, not from his perspective. And this flaw of Tsarus Ayin has earth-shattering implications. And the most destructive thing about it is that it ultimately does not allow a person to fully accept Hashem. If a person is too narrow-eyed and sees everything from his perspective, unable to see the other person's perspective, then he will not be able to see things from a higher perspective, which is even much more distant from us. Therefore, their particular malady of narrow eyes made even the Torah that they studied, and we could never, never understand the sensitivity of this judgment, because we would never notice it, we would never perceive it. But on their level, it had creeped in to the relationship that they had with the Torah and with God because of this narrow eyes. That's, once again, that is the most important value that is needed to live Sefer Bamidbar, is to have a wide-eye view, an accepting view, a view in which a person, at the same time that he is self-aware and fully aware of his strengths, of the prat, at the same time can see the klal, doesn't lose the big picture because of his small view. There's an expression which I picked up from my secular readings of Stephen Covey called abundance mentality. Anybody heard of that? Abundance mentality, to me, it's the opposite of Tsarus Ayin. It's the ability to see more is better. Two opinions on a matter is better than one opinion. Right? A narrow-eyed person would say, only one opinion is important. That's mine. His opinion, that's a nuisance. That's competing. That's the distraction. Abundance mentality says, two opinions is better than one opinion. Two people on the project is better than one. Five people is better than two. A tribe is better than a family. A nation is better than just a tribe. I mean, again, that's not to deny the prat. That's not to deny the important, the vital function of every one of those pratim. But not just to see the prat, but to see the klal beyond. And so once again, we could say that this is the same theme. The theme of Shavuos, the theme of opening ourselves up to the klal of the Torah, means that we have to be able to look at the person next to us and be able to perceive their view as well. I just wanted to close with Rabbi Tatz, which I started to read. Steps to Self-Expression. This is in one of my favorite books now, The Thinking Jewish Teenager's Guide to Life. I guess I'm at age 13 or 14 right now. Steps to Self-Expression. This knowledge can illuminate your path. By the way, I'm reading part of a chapter which started off with Rav Dessler's explanations of the camp of the desert. This was inspired by the passage from Rav Dessler that I mentioned before. So he speaks about the idea of the individual and the group. And this knowledge can illuminate your path and help you define exactly what your role should be, exactly what your goal should be in this world. In order to begin the path of genuine self-development, you must learn to reject the mode of today's culture, which sees the world as existing to serve the individual's self-interest. I'm sorry to say, fellow Americans, but what we've been taught is not a Torah value. That everyone is entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Rights of the individual? That's not a Jewish concept. I'm sorry. I mean, I sing the Star Spangled Banner too, but that's not what it's all about. It's not about my rights. That's basically a prat without a klal. Sure, I need the klal so that I can have my rights. No. Let's listen to Rabbi Tatz. You must look beyond yourself and you must look above yourself. If you cannot become a part of that which is around you and that which is above you, you can never become greater than your own personal limits. If you cannot really give of yourself to anyone or anything else, you will forever be alone in your undeveloped smallness. When you have begun to resolve the conflict of living as part of a greater reality, and yet in that greater expanded reality, discover your own individual uniqueness, you have begun to walk the long road that leads to real maturity and real greatness. So there are two phases. First, you must strive to discover your uniqueness. What is your particular task? What essential part of the world is yours to build? This question is critically important. A life spent pursuing some unrealistic and inappropriate goal is a life wasted. And worse, it damages the entire world. This is what we read before. When that small and seemingly insignificant screw in that engine, which we considered previously, falls out of place and rattles around in the wrong part of the engine, the entire engine may be irreparably damaged. Second, you are to develop the depth. Now, it's great if you can read this when you're 13 or 14, but it's never too late. Second, you have to develop the depth to see that the thrill of fitting in is a much more mature experience than the thrill of being a loner at any cost. The immature personality will choose to step out of line in order to experience its own uniqueness. The fact that the overall structure is being betrayed and damaged is not relevant to such an undeveloped mind. Immaturity cannot see the beauty in yielding the self in order to actualize the self. In truth, however, that is the only way to genuine selfhood. It's a major theme. If we were to define the five top themes of the Torah, this is going to be one of them. Klal and Prat. Being unique in being part of the Klal. So, let's try it on. Let's see if it works as we continue to study Sefer Bamidbar together. Yeah, Dr. Schultz.
To the klal and the prat. Is that part of our oral tradition, or was it introduced at a later time by the rabbinical?
It's a good question. I don't know the original usage. I know it's in the Talmud. The Torah is written in the form of klal and prat. The Talmud points out that very often the Torah will say, it will give a law. Like, for example, and this could apply to the most technical of ideas. Where does it say about the lost object? Oh, yeah, that's in Kiseitse. Let me give you an example of this. Okay. You shall not see the ox of your brother or his sheep or goat cast off and hide yourself from them. You shall surely return them to your brother. Okay, so shall you do for his donkey, so shall you do for his garment, so shall you do for any lost article of your brother that may be lost. So the Talmud points out, the Torah writes, pratim, donkey, garment, that's a prat, and then also a klal. So shall you do for any lost article of your brother. That's a general thing. And so the Talmud says, for example, by writing things in the form of prat and then klal, it's teaching us something. Sometimes the Torah writes the klal first, and then the prat. Sometimes it's klal, prat, klal. What I'm pointing out is, this seems to be far afield of our discussion today, but the notion that there are general sets and then individual parts is something which is almost part of the Torah vocabulary. And these commentators or more philosophical thinkers are just applying that to anything. You can say Rabbi Luzzatto, who writes the encyclopedia, bases it on this principle. First we will tell you the klal, we'll tell you the general things, knowledge about God, and now we'll break it down, man. And it's just a way of analyzing and of organizing and understanding how things work. So it's basic.
The written Torah would not be understandable without the oral.
Correct.
So what's written there could be interpreted in many different ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then we now learn about the klal and the prat,
mm-hmm.
which were introduced sometime in history,
mm-hmm.
either during the time of the oral Torah or...
Yeah, but it's part of the fabric. Whoever wrote it down is not, to me, is not material. It's part of the fabric of creation. The fact that there is a God who encompasses everything, and then he created a world with visible different parts to it, that's an illustration of klal and prat. The fact that the entire world started with the creation of one man, and then that man reproduced to the point where there were three patriarchs, and three patriarchs became 12 tribes, and 12 tribes became 70 souls, and 70 souls became 600,000, that's an illustration of klal and prat. So it's just part of the fabric of creation. Who was the first person to write it down? Not sure, but that's not material in the larger scheme. Have a wonderful Shabbos and a wonderful Shavuos. May we accept the Torah with inspiration.
Thank you for the
lesson. You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.